So good evening. And I feel, and it's for some reason I don't understand, I feel a little bit mischievous. I don't know what to do with that either. I just feel that way. So, but I think it has a little bit to do with the topic for today. And because what I'd like to do is to continue on the topic from last week, which is talking about mindfulness of thought, mindfulness of thinking. And so I don't know the connection between that topic and being mischievous, but you know, it's kind of like the mind is pretty mischievous. And the practice sometimes feels kind of, the mindfulness of thinking, mindfulness of thought, is kind of a, well, it's many different things. To really become clearly aware that you're thinking and what you're thinking, be aware of what you're thinking when you're thinking, can lead to a kaleidoscope of feelings. And it certainly can lead to discouragement. It can lead to embarrassment. I mean, imagine if we've been sitting here for 45 minutes and we've taken one of you and projected your thoughts up on the wall there for 45 minutes. And probably a few of you would have been embarrassed and some other thoughts would have occurred. And but also there's something, you know, also there can be something humorous about watching your own thoughts. I mean, it's a lot easier if you can be humored by what you see in there as you track your thoughts. As I like to say, there's a saying, it's a good thing to be able to laugh at yourself because then you'll never stop being humored. And so to be able to, you know, it's kind of an amazing thing to watch carefully your own thoughts and have them kind of slip and slide away and fade away and come back kind of through a back door or kind of sneak up again from the side. Or there's this wonderful thing of infinite regress. You watch, you notice you're thinking, but that's a thought, a little bit. And then you notice that you're thinking about having thought, had a thought. And then you notice that, you know, and it can be this wonderful, you know, it goes gone forever. After a while, you stop and think about something else. And I think it's a very rich area of human life, thinking, as I said last week. And I want to follow up today with it some more. And in particular, what I'd like to do is to focus on another discourse on the Buddha, the one preceding the one I referred to last week, where the Buddha, again, and from a different angle, addresses the issue of thinking and thoughts and how he handled his own thinking mind during his own meditation practice, spiritual practice. But I do want to say a few introductory words on this topic. And I'm hoping that in giving this talk that a good majority of you were here last week when I gave a talk on thinking, and that you've been thinking about it and investigating, exploring the world of your thoughts and what it's like to be mindful of thoughts during this last week. So I'm not speaking into kind of people who are uninitiated so much about this topic. When we see the world or experience the world through our thinking, through our thoughts, we get usually get a very particular slant or particular angles by which we then understand the world. And you might think that the only way you can understand the world is through your thoughts. Some people, that's what they think or how they act, at least. But often, according to the teachings of Buddhism, our thinking is often inaccurate. And part of the function of meditation practice is to correct the inverted or unuseful ways in which the mind thinks. So one way to explore this, perhaps, is to start with a little exercise. Simple exercise. And for this, if you would close your eyes. Or actually, I'm sorry. Before you close your eyes, so I think most of us here, we all have hands. And who can tell me what a hand is? And there's no wrong answer, just as long as you're in the ballpark. But who can tell me what a hand is? Tell me. I want someone to tell me. Yes? Good. It's the thing at the end of your arm. Some other explanations of what a hand is.
It's a tool.
It's a tool.
5 fingers and a thumb.
5 fingers and a thumb.
This.
Yes.
A group of cards I'm given.
That's another definition of hand, but I'm referring to this hand here. That's very important for this exercise.
It's a thought.
So a hand is a thought. A hand is a thought?
A concept.
But what kind of concepts do you have that explains what a hand is? Hand is grasping, or hand is something that can grasp? The hand is something that can grasp. So, you know, we can have a lot of different thoughts or definition ideas of what a hand is and what your hand is. As each of you probably have spent some time looking at your hand, and some people I know have come to conclusions about their hands. The hand is too big or too small, or the fingers are too narrow, or those fingernails are just not quite right, or the knuckles are too hairy. There's a lot of conclusions you can make, a lot of things you could do. And if you haven't done this before, I'm sorry to have brought up the possibility. And so now, having introduced your hand this way, so now if you would close your hands. Close your hands. Close your eyes. Close your hands too if you want. Close your eyes. And then take your left hand and just feel it. Just be aware of your left hand. Bring awareness to your left hand. And become aware of how the body, how the hand experiences itself. How does the hand experience itself? What are the sensations? Just maybe without touching it even, just kind of feeling the left hand, the way it experiences itself, if it's left alone. The pulsing, the vibration, the warmth, the coolness, the movement. Maybe even keeping the hand still and letting just the sensations speak for themselves. Feeling the particular sensations that appear on their own of the hand. Are those sensations fixed, or do they move, or they vibrate, or pulse, or how solid are they? So if there's no thoughts, no concepts for that experience of a left hand, how is the hand experienced for itself? And how is the way the hand experiences itself different from the concepts and definitions you might have of what a hand is? Or the image of you have. If you keep your eyes closed, you don't even have the image perhaps, just the sensations. How is it different from word or image concepts you have? Okay, and then you can open your eyes. So, what was the difference? Could you tell a difference between the two ways of, kind of in a sense, being with your hands or understanding your hands? Like it felt like energy.
It was not a feeling, but it was moving, like tingling, but it was always changing.
Uh-huh. So tingling was always changing, yes.
The difference in my mind was before the exercise, my concept of my hand was what I can do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And meditating on it, it just became a location of sensory feeling.
Mm-hmm. So the first one was the hand was what you could do with it, and that seems, you know, in some ways somewhat abstract, because it's the potential the hand has, as opposed to what it actually is in the moment, right? Yes.
Well, I thought of the hand as an abstract biological a concept about a biological mind.
Yeah.
The exercise feeling that I defined it according to its boundaries. You know, it was defined by what it was not.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't the technical cloth that it was touching. It wasn't the air that it was touching. But it had a structure that meant that it was not those things.
Uh-huh.
It was not a definition of itself.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So a structure. But if you have the hand just in the air like this, without touching anything,
it's touching the air.
Somehow
that defined it as not the air.
Uh-huh. And what about the hand's experience of itself?
Yeah, it seems to be experiencing itself by what it was not. It wasn't the other things, but not the... Yeah, I wasn't able to do that.
Uh-huh. That's very interesting.
And hand experience itself independently.
I think the, to some degree it can, the as sensation, sensing happens where the sensations are.
Doesn't sensation come from the brain or the mind?
Well, there's certainly a knowing in the brain and an awareness of what it is, a cognition that goes on in the mind, in the brain. But exactly where it all works within the relationship to the brain up here, I'm not a neurophysiologist, so I don't exactly know. But in my subjective experience, the sensing of like touching my fingers together, the sensing of that pressure happens in the place where the pressure is going on. The knowing that it's pressure happens maybe someplace else. But the sensing that's before the knowing, in a sense, that happens in the place where the sensation occurs. So there's a non-dualism between sensing and sensations. There's no sensation without sensing and no sensing without sensation. And subjectively, I think that occurs in the same place. So I try to get to that by saying the hand's experience of itself. So I hope you got a sense of the difference between knowing something through your concepts and ideas and thoughts that you might have and knowing something in a very different way, more directly, experientially. There's a huge difference between the two of it. Now, most of the time, I would suggest people are experiencing the world through that filter of their thoughts and their ideas. And their thoughts and ideas sometimes are accurate, but thoughts and ideas often experience things, when experiencing things as concepts or images, it tends to give things a certain kind of solidity that it's not, that's not actually there in reality. So if you have an image, the image becomes kind of like a picture. And you have this picture. It's like you have an image of your friend and you carry that image with you and from the last time you saw your friend. And that image doesn't change any until you see the person again. But in the week between seeing the person, maybe the person's changed a lot. They've gotten a haircut, for example. And, you know, I wasn't expecting that, you know. So, whoop, that's not my image. What happened? And we carry an image. And the image sometimes tends towards more solidity, constancy, permanence than what reality might be. And so there's often the part of function of thinking is to add a sense of stability or permanence to our experience. Human beings, as a community of beings, are very, not everyone, but are extremely driven by wanting things to be permanent. They want things to be stable and set. I mean, we have laws, we have traffic lights that make things kind of always be the same way, we have signs, we have, banks that are so stable and permanent, they have those columns in front that show you that's the case. And And you know, we kind of like stability and permanence. It's often been pointed out that many people will logically, rationally know they're going to die, but it's not really something that kind of has gone in deeply into their psyche. They kind of act as if it's going to be forever. Some people, especially if you're young, this can be the case. But there's a kind of tendency or bias towards permanence, and things are always going to be this way. Some of you have been the recipient of the image of other people. Other people had an image of you, and you've actually changed, but they haven't been able to see how you've changed and to meet you as you've actually changed. They see you in the old way. So one of the problems of thinking is it tends to bias our experience of the world in the direction of permanence, that things are solid and fixed. And this is one of the inverted views that the Buddha said people tend to carry with them that needs to be corrected so we can see things more accurately. And one of the ways Buddha wants to help us see that the world is impermanent, changing much more than thoughts tend to allow it. So the experience of the hand is, from, you know, in some sense, fluxing and moving, and the sensations of the hand all the time. The image, the idea of a hand doesn't change very much. But if you close your eyes and just experience the hand's experience of itself, it's a lot of sensations that are bubbling and changing and all that. Thoughts also lend themselves to another kind of bias, and that is a bias of taking things personally. I suspect it's part of the biological evolutionary function of thinking is to help create a sense of self and take care of the sense of self and carry ourselves as selves into the world. But the sense of self that we carry is often a very complex animal, complex event. It seems very innocent and simple that here I am, I'm a self here. But that simple, innocent sense of I am here is a magnet for all kinds of ideas, thoughts, images of what a self is supposed to be like, who I am in relationship to other people, what a good self is, what a bad self is, who I am based on my past experience. Some people carry their past experience with them, and this is who I am. I failed that exam when I was in high school. I am the person who's always going to fail exams. We carry that image. And this is the way it's going to be. So we tend to take things very much personally through the filter of our thoughts. And part of the work of Dharma practice is to help lighten up or loosen up the fixation of taking things very personally. I suspect that most of us, if we tracked what we're actually thinking about during the course of the day, there would be a huge majority of the thoughts that we have are in some way or other self-referential. What? A huge percentage of our thoughts are self-referential, referring to ourselves, having to do with we're in the middle of the picture or the story or repeating a conversation we had or planning the future for ourselves or imagining the most wonderful vacation or sexual partner or, you know, it's all about, you know, we're in the picture in some way or other. A lot of self-criticism. There's an epidemic in our society of people who have self-critical and feel that they're unworthy. There's not as many people, but there's some who feel the opposite. I'm the best. Some people that have the wonderful fortune of swinging between the two because they kind of sometimes, you know, they bounce off each other. Our thinking, for whatever reason, tends to be biased towards taking things personally. And that personal bias is another filter that's not really accurate. Is everything you think personal? Is it you? Are you responsible for everything you think? Every thought that arises, is that your thought? Did you make it happen? I mean, did someone else make it happen? Listen to this. I can plant a thought in your mind against your will. You have to listen. You can't walk away. You have to stay for the exercise. But I bet 99% of you, I can plant a thought. Should I do it? Try not to, okay? Really try not to. It's a little concept, right? Now really try your best. Okay, I'll do two versions for the different generations here. One might work better for the other. So The hills are alive with the sound of... Did you fill out the blank? And then for younger people, we'll say something like, we will. Now, were you able to... How powerful was your mind? Could you block my mind melding? Now, who was responsible for you having that thought, that idea popped up in your mind? Am I responsible? Probably. You know, things arise. Our thinking is conditioned. To some degree, it's mechanical. Events happen, situations happen, thoughts arise, and it kind of chain of association happens. It's kind of like some of the thoughts are just kind of like, who knows where they come from? They're, now I know. So, how personal do we take our thoughts? Are they us? Do they define who I am? Are they random? Are they mechanical? Are they conditioned by society and our experiences in life and everything? Our thoughts are, you know, it's best not to take them too personally. Another inverted view that Buddha pointed to is that people believe that there's a strong bias in thinking to try to find something which is reliable. Or let's say it this way, not fine, but to attribute reliability to things which offer no lasting reliability. So I can't think of a good example right now, but anything's an example. But the stock market's reliable. That's pretty bad, right? But maybe that your car is reliable. Most of you don't think that, probably. But that your relationship is reliable. Well, some of you don't think that. Buddha said people tend to look for things which are going to provide reliable and lasting form of satisfaction and happiness. Attribute that to all kinds of things. If only I could have a house, a job, a partner, a recreational opportunity, you know, good weather, better clothes, a good haircut, you know, if only, then that is going to be what does it for me. I'm going to be happy. So we attribute, we look at things, this is what's going to be, this is reliable for providing me with happiness. And so there's that bias, that twist in our thinking that we kind of assume that something, often in the future, or that we project it forward, that's it, that's going to do it for us. And so then people will chase the Holy Grail. And I've known people who've chased it forever, never finding it. I've known people who found what they thought was going to do it, and it didn't do it, and they looked for the next thing, and they're kind of going like this all the time. I can remember very well as a kid, maybe I was 9 years old, really, it was so important. I really wanted this plastic toy machine gun for Christmas. It was like my life depended on it. It was like this really important thing. It had a battery, and you could, you know, do all these great things with this electric machine gun. So I guess I wanted it so badly that my parents got me this electric machine gun. And you know how long it kept my interest? Probably 5 minutes, you know, and I never picked it up again. But I thought it was going to do it for me. You know, that was the solution. So I don't know if this, you know, hopefully you can kind of translate this in your own life, but the Buddha said there's these three inverted ways of thinking that people have. Looking at what is impermanent as permanent, looking at what is impersonal as personal, and looking at what is not reliable as reliable, ultimately reliable. And so our thinking tends towards certain kind of bias. Not always. I mean, that thinking can also be accurate and very creative and insightful and all kinds of wonderful things. But there's often this difficulty with our thinking. Now there's a famous, somewhat famous expression, don't confuse the map for the territory, for the land. And in a sense, when thinking is relating to the world around us, to the experiential world, sometimes we take the thoughts as the what is really describing what's actually there. It's like it's really the map. It's the pointers. It's the indicators. It's the signifiers that are pointing us in a direction. But sometimes we confuse what it says in Zen, the finger for the moon. We confuse the signifier as being the real thing. But it isn't the real thing. Things change all the time. The image I like is that idea of you go down to the river and put a bucket in the water and you pull up a bucket full of water from the river and you go around saying, "Look, I have the river here." Or you take a snapshot of your friend and you go around saying, you know, 20 years later, you're still holding the snapshot, and this is my friend. We take a signifier for somehow being the thing. And so part of the function of Dharma practice is begin to loosen up the ways which we relate to concepts and thoughts. So we don't take thoughts so heavy, so strongly, and we don't take thoughts in such an absolute way, but rather something, they're tools, they have their usefulness, and we kind of know how to negotiate around them and with them. And not be fooled by them. That's a very important part of practice. Learning to have that kind of mindfulness of thought, that kind of awareness of thought, and that kind of takes practice. Most people don't spend much time tracking their thoughts, watching their thoughts, really watching them. One interesting exercise to do, maybe in meditation, is take 10 minutes, or the whole period of meditation, but take a period of time, and then count how many thoughts you have during that period of time. You know, that's very interesting. And maybe do that over several different kind of days. Different kind of days you're having, you know, good days, bad days, you know, agitated days, calm days. And then count how quickly, how many thoughts you have. And see what happens when you start counting your thoughts. It's fascinating. But to track and watch your thinking, to be an observer of your thoughts as opposed to be a participant. You don't have, thinking is not necessarily a participatory sport. It can also be kind of, you know, the audience. You can watch the thoughts go by and track and see. And there's a lot of very important things to learn by watching your own thoughts. If you're tracking your thoughts, it might be a revelation to realize how often you're thinking the same thing. You had no idea. Some people will report they have, the top three tunes. And they seem to go cycle through the same thing over and over again, the same kind of thoughts and concerns. So the map is not the territory. As we track the thoughts and learn to loosen up the grip on them, then one of the options we have is to be able to choose which thoughts to follow and which not to follow, which to act on. Which not to act on, which to continue thinking, and which to let go of. And this opportunity, this possibility we have of choosing what we think, we can't necessarily choose what pops up in our mind, but we can choose what we follow. So in this regard, I distinguish between thinking, which is an English word, and a word I think should be in English, but hasn't made the dictionary yet, called thoughting. Thinking and thoughting. And thoughting is just what the mind does. It's a thought machine. It tends to create thoughts. Thinking is when we pick up a thought and create a chain of association, a causal link. We're involved in it. And what the mind does is thought. But you have some choice about whether you get involved in a thought that has arisen. Some people don't know they have that choice or haven't exercised that muscle, and so they don't really have that ability. They just kind of tugged around and pulled around by their thoughts. And when it gets close to, was it April 15th, tax day? Then their mind is pulled into tax thoughts. And some people, you know, don't study for exams until they really kind of like, it's the night before, because they're not, you know, they don't have any way of kind of finding the motivation unless there's something powerful driving them inside to think that way, to get the mind that thoughts that go in that direction. But to start having some control or some choice around thinking is part of what the Buddha realized he had on his way to becoming enlightened. So there's this discourse, it's discourse 19 in the Middle Length Discourses, where the Buddha says, prior to my enlightenment, I divided my thinking into two classes of thoughts. I divided my thinking into those thoughts which had that were based or driven by sensual desire, cruelty, or hostility. Here it says sensual desire, ill will, and cruelty. And the other side, he had thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, and thoughts of non-cruelty. The word non, when the word non appears like this, it actually implies the positive. So non-ill will is thoughts of love, of kindness, of friendliness, and non-cruelty is thoughts of compassion. So he's dividing up his thoughts into two categories. Not all, they don't all fit into these two categories, but he saw these two categories. And then he thought, when sensual desire, the thoughts of sensual desire, sensual craving arise for me, I realize this leads to my own affliction and to the affliction of others. It leads to harm to myself and leads harm to others. So you have to kind of stretch your mind a little bit. Not all sensual desire automatically does that, but sensual craving, sensual addiction can cause a lot of difficulties. It doesn't take a lot of thinking to realize that. And to affliction to both. Sensual desire can obstruct wisdom. It can cause difficulties. And it leads away from freedom. So sensual desire can do that. If you're in the grips of sensual desire, there can be very little freedom there. So he had the same understanding around thoughts of cruelty and thoughts of ill will. That thoughts of ill will are not for my own benefit. They harm myself. They harm others. They harm both of us. They block wisdom. They block the way to freedom. And they cause a lot of difficulties. So then, having these kinds of thoughts, when these kinds of thoughts arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, and did away with it. So if he had thoughts of ill will, thoughts of cruelty, or thoughts of sensual desire, he did away with it. Now, this thing of sensual desire is interesting, because the Buddha was a meditator here. He was engaged in very deep spiritual practice. And part of the point of spiritual practice is to really learn how to set the mind radically free into the present moment. And when the mind is really trying to do it in a very radical way, very complete and thorough way, any movement towards sensual pleasure, to wanting pleasure which is not happening right now, takes you out of the present moment. And even in meditation, you realize even subtle things have a certain kind of irritation or suffering or pressure or tension or stress involved. Whereas in daily life, we're so stressed out all the time some thoughts of sensual pleasure can be a relief compared to what you are thinking about. But when you get into very subtle, peaceful meditation, even subtle movements or sensual desire is not as beautiful or pleasant as a mind which is settled and calm and present right now and here. So he had the ability of letting go of these kinds of thoughts. Now, probably this is because he'd already been a practitioner for a long time. It takes a while for people who are unpracticed to learn the skill and the ability to have the strength. No, I'm not going to think this. Thank you. Let go of it. Just drop it. And it takes a skill to learn how to drop it and let go of it in a healthy way. Not to push it away or repress it or kind of pretend it's not there. There's healthy ways and unhealthy ways of letting go of thoughts which are not helpful. Then the Buddha said, whatever a person frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his or her mind. If he or she frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of sensual desire, he or she has abandoned then the thoughts of letting go in order to cultivate sensual desire. And then his mind will incline to thoughts of sensual desire. If he or she frequently thinks about ill will or about cruelty, the mind will then tend further, create a disposition, a habit to go more in that direction. So then he does the same thing with these more wholesome or skillful states of mind. When thoughts of renunciation, letting go, arose in me, he realized that this does not lead to my own affliction, to others' affliction, or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, it does not cause difficulties, and it leads to freedom. So here, letting go, he saw the benefits. Now, this also has to be understood wisely. There's unwise ways of letting go and wise ways of letting go, of renunciation. So that's a whole topic for another time. But here we just go along with him. And so he saw something in the nature of renunciation and letting go which was supportive in the movement of freedom. And he understood something about renunciation which never caused harm to yourself or to others. Mostly when people get aversive to renunciation, they think it's going to cause them harm. And here the Buddha's understanding of renunciation, which again is a topic for another time, is it does not cause harm to oneself, does not cause harm to others. So this does not have to be let go of in terms, because of the harm that it causes. But then he says something very interesting. So he says this is skillful, this is useful, it doesn't cause harm exactly. But he says, if I think and ponder upon this thought even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and a day, I see nothing to fear from it. So it's good. So you think about renunciation or love or compassion a lot, that it becomes the inclination of the mind, this vision of the mind. That's really good. Nothing to fear about that. However, with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes disturbed. And when the mind is disturbed, it is far from concentration. So even with wholesome, skillful, good things to think about, if you think about them too much, it creates certain agitation. It tires the mind out and agitates the mind. It makes it difficult for the mind to get peaceful, steady, and concentrated. I think a lot of people in our society know what it's like to have a thinking mind which has led the mind to a state of weariness, to exhaustion. Most people are so distracted by their thoughts to even notice that. But if you sit down and meditate for a while, some people will find, wow, my thinking mind is so tired, so weary, just churning and going and going and going. And it really needs to rest. So even thinking good things, done too much, can weary the mind. So to give it real rest, a real vacation, the Buddha then steadied his mind internally, quieted it, brought it to one single-pointed focus, and concentrated. Why is this? So that my mind should not be disturbed. So it's a place of very deep rest. Part of the function of concentration practice in Buddhism is to provide the mind with a phenomenal sense of rest, relief, peace that is better than any vacation you can imagine. To really because even vacations, if you have a strong habit to think all the time, you take your thinking with you. And meditation is one of the places where you can let it kind of really calm down radically, fully. So the Buddha then divided his thoughts into these two categories. Elsewhere, he divided them differently. Just much more generally, between those thoughts which are skillful and those thoughts which are not skillful. So those thoughts which are helpful for us and those which are not helpful for us. And those which are not helpful, let go of. Those which are helpful, we should then follow up on, maybe, up to a certain point. This is a very interesting teaching. Because, and so it has its strengths, and this teaching has some weaknesses. And I like to kind of contrast this with what I believe is a very common tendency among people in the West when they're looking at thoughts and thinking. And it maybe it's because in the modern West, we have become a very psychologized culture. And so we have certain psychological habits now because we just kind of, you know, it's in their cultural mother's milk. You know, we just kind of imbue it, you know, drink it from our society. And that is, when we look at thinking and thoughts, we tend to, and try to understand the thoughts and why we're thinking certain things, we tend to look back into the past. The cause and condition in the past, what caused those to arise? Our earlier experience in life, what happened to us in the day before, earlier, or sometimes it's psychological, we tend to look into the roots in the present moment, but we kind of look, what are my deeper motivations, what are the feelings, what are the emotions that cause these thoughts to arise? All that is useful. And it's kind of strength of Western culture, that's kind of psychology, that's kind of really learned to look at this in a wise way, understand it's working. Done too much, it's a weakness. It's both a strength and a weakness. The Buddhist approach, the way the Buddha talked about it, he tended not to look back in time so much, the causes and conditions. We looked at thoughts, but rather he looked at thoughts more functionally and what is useful for creating good conditions in the future. What do I do with my thinking mind in order to create good results for me in the future, benefits for me in the future, as I go forward here? So can I let go of thoughts of ill will? Can I let go of thoughts of cruelty? Can I pick up and act on thoughts of renunciation? Can I pick up and think about thoughts of loving kindness and compassion so that my mind can incline in that direction more into the future? So to create the conditions for a better future rather than look back into the past. Here in the West, as the Dharma practice, Buddhist practice has come here, and this, you have this mingling of psychotherapy and Buddhism, you find that we teach actually it's important to do both. There are times it's really important to go back and look at the deeper emotional roots, psychological roots for what we're thinking, what we're obsessed by. But we don't want to do too much. It's a trap to do it. You can caught in, it's like a maze you'll never get out of if you go in too far. And for some of us, we need to kind of learn the skill the Buddha was pointing at, which is be more pragmatic and look at what creates better results. Don't get caught up in the past. Don't get caught up in a victim mentality or all kinds of other mentalities of being in the past. Just kind of be more constructive, more purposeful, and see what can I do here that helps me out. There's so much to say, and time's up. I'd like to end with one little, another, maybe exercise around thinking. And that is, if you can track and watch your mind as it thinks, really be cognizant, really be clearly aware that you're thinking when you think. And then watch your thinking, train of thought, when it comes to an end. And hopefully there's a little gap before the next thought. You know, next sentence, if you think in sentences, or the next image, if you have images. Like an image ends, an auditory kind of thought ends. And you look at it when it comes to an end. And before the next thought arises, relax into the mind that has no thoughts. Or look, what's the nature of the mind when there is no thoughts happening? What is that? What's the nature of your mind? What's the quality? What's the character? What's the texture? What's it like? There's something very liberating. Many teachers have pointed out that there's something very liberating about looking beyond or around or between the thoughts into the nature of that mind which has no thinking, no thoughts. It's hard to do because we tend to think right away. But what is that? So the more aware, wiser you are around thinking, the more you learn to be mindful and really see it clearly and well, the more the opportunity will be that you can see through it, around it, between it, into some point of freedom. So, good luck. So I hope this has been useful. And I hope that as was the spirit or the intention of the talk last week, the spirit of this week's talk is to basically give you some ideas, some encouragement to really investigate for yourself the nature of your own thinking. Become aware of it, explore it. Don't assume that the Buddha was right when, or that I'm right about the nature of thinking, but make it your own exploration, your own study, and find out what is really true for yourself. And then, once you've done it on your own, go find a friend that you kind of respect and share your insights and discoveries around the world of your thinking with them, and you know, have a conversation about it. Don't just keep it to yourself. Thank you.